we want to do it all on our own, but we do it half-assed, right? Like, you don't know what you don't know. And so rather than sit with a CPA who can tell you all the ins and outs of navigating, you know, the tax loopholes, you want to go to H&R Block and, you know, try to get back the most money that you can, or you want to do it on TurboTax for free. So I think that's an element of it. It's just the ignorance. And I think another part of it is just, you know, not wanting to take the own, your own personal accountability to, like you said, do the research and figure it out.
Welcome to The Culture's Money. The Culture's Money is a podcast created to discuss how we multiply the $1.2 trillion in spending power possessed by the American Black community through the vehicles of investing, personal finance, ownership, networking, and most importantly, collaboration. We are the culture, baby, and we are the financing that we've been seeking. Now, let's get into this money talk. And here's your host, Jamal Vitos.
Welcome back, culture members. This is another episode of The Culture of Money. My name is Jamal Vitos. Some of you may know me on other social media platforms as Leo Grand Prince, but however it is that you know me, I hope you know me as an advocate for financial literacy, generational wealth, entrepreneurship, and just overall culture empowerment. I'm excited to have yet another brother on the show today. The women have been dominating it for episodes and episodes, and I definitely appreciate their contribution, but I always feel like there's color and input that another Black man can add to the concept of entrepreneurship, money, and everything in that matter. So I'm happy to bring onto the show to you guys, Mr. Rakim.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
No problem. I appreciate you spending some time with us today. I always, that's always a sacred thing to me. I know it's very trendy for people to say that, you know, your most precious commodity is time, but I really believe that. Like, and I think you probably couldn't relate being in the financial field like me, that time is definitely money.
Absolutely.
So before we get into kind of tell the people about you, how did you get into financial literacy, financial empowerment, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. So my name is Rakim Sabri. I've been doing this for a little while now, but have really, I guess, exploded on the scene within the last 2 years. 2019, I did a TED Talk on financial empowerment. 2019, I put out my book on financial empowerment called Financially Irresponsible. And since then, I've been everywhere. I contribute to Entrepreneur. I've written for The Griot. I've been featured in Business Insider, Thrive, Black Enterprise, Yahoo Finance, some local news articles will syndicate some of the things that I write. So I really became passionate about getting the word out there as I started to kind of develop and realize that I had specialized knowledge, right? Things that not everybody walks around knowing, but things that everybody should walk around knowing. And so that's really kind of like my niche within a niche. I realize there's a lot of people in the financial literacy space. And so we're telling people, you know, what are best practices and you should have a savings account and how much you should save, but we're not working on the mindset piece, the empowerment piece, and saying, well, sure, these things are possible. Sure, these are things that we know that we should be doing. But do we believe that those things are for us, or do we believe that those things are possible for us? So I've kind of created some various, you know, products. You know, like I said, I have a book out there. I have the TED Talk. I've participated in different people's podcasts. I do financial coaching. I just try to be really consistent with providing content, not from the perspective of an expert, because, you know, I want people to see the flaws in my practice as well. I want people to understand that I'm still learning.
That's a bar. Already you dropped a jab. Not from the perspective of an expert. And I'm so with you on that, but keep going.
But I want people to see, you know, that personal finance is indeed personal. And, you know, the greats, if you will, and I'm using air quotes, when you talk about like the Robert Kiyosakis and the Dave Ramseys and, you know, first of all of the non-Black financial gurus, but people who are assigned, you know, their word is law, don't create content for our audience or You know, they say that this is this and people run with it. There's no variation. There's no color, like you mentioned, and there's no culture. So that's my mission, to be as human as possible while still establishing some level of authoritative context, right? And saying, okay, yes, I've been in the field. I've done this. This is where I've seen success. But because it works for me doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work for you that way. And that's okay. You don't have to do what it is that I did, and you don't have to avoid the things that I avoided, as long as you understand what are the foundations and basics of financial literacy, and you feel empowered to go about that however you choose to. That's going to be the right answer.
Yeah, this is why I love doing the podcast the way I do, because you give me so much stuff to go on. But before I kind of jump in there, tell me how it was doing a TED Talk. I don't necessarily think that's a goal of mine. I mean, maybe I'm being a little bit I don't want to say scared, but maybe I'm being a little bit reserved, because I just don't think it's a goal of mine to stand in front of a bunch of people and record something like that. But how was that experience, and how did that change your, you know, professional trajectory and everything like that?
Excellent experience. It was something that I wanted. It was something that I wanted badly. So I started speaking in 2018, and I had watched two phenomenal women deliver presentations, and I said, you know what, I can do this. I want to do this. And I, at the end of those presentations, walked up to the both of them and said, you know, how did you guys get into this line of work? And what is it that I have to do that? And one of them, lady from the Caribbean, full of energy, definitely a mentor to me to this day, gave me some feedback. And I think she kind of half expected that I was not going to do the things that she told me to do. And I did those things, and I came back to her after I don't know how long and was like, okay, like, I did it. Now what? And she's like, oh, you were serious. And then, you know, we started really kind of laying the groundwork. So I realized that I needed to establish credibility as quickly as possible as a speaker. I have been considered by others to be a really good speaker, but I don't know that I had the confidence necessarily in myself to go out and do that. Mm-hmm. And so in my eyes, and in the eyes of many, you know, what is a bigger piece of credibility as a speaker than TED? So that's something that I went after. The experience itself was very nerve-wracking. I don't think I've been as nervous as I was ever up on that stage. There was probably two or three instances during my talk that I completely forgot what I was going to say. So, you know, you have to learn how to be agile and how to recover quickly. There's a lot of practice that goes into it. And then, of course, you know, you have to get over your nerves. But it was really kind of like, I want to use a really like dramatic analogy here. It wasn't like the opening of doors. It was like the bulldozing of doors for me to have TED associated with my name, because people are just like, oh, you did a TED Talk? You did a TED Talk? You did a TED Talk? And it's just like, yep. And, you know, it's a different skill set to get up in front of an audience and speak for any length of time, but certainly over 5 or 10 minutes without getting the feedback back. Mm-hmm. I tell people all the time, I am an introvert by nature. I can have conversations and exhibit extrovert tendencies if I have something to go off of, even if I get like or, you know, some kind of indication that you're hearing what I'm saying and that it's resonating with you, that will keep me going. But, you know, when you have all of these eyes, hundreds of eyes looking at you and not saying anything, it's like, all right, like, how do I keep this conversation going? So definitely having to know your stuff, feeling comfortable with silences, feeling comfortable commanding those silences, all skills that I've had to learn, very different from you know, a casual conversation like this, or even and I know we're going to get into like my financial background, but sitting in a boardroom and having a meeting with, you know, presentations and what have you, like, just very different skill set.
Okay. You said something in the beginning when you were introducing yourself. It's like, not to the financial literacy and financial responsibility from the level of an expert. Can you expand that on a little bit more?
Yeah, so I've been reflecting on it quite a bit lately. When I first started really kind of taking control of my personal brand and the way that that looked out in, you know, the electronic footprint, right? I wanted to use titles that call people's attention. So there were instances where, you know, if I was doing an interview, I would say, you know, personal finance expert ahead of my name, because, you know, you want to stack these accolades and make people like, oh, this guy is so impressive. But then I realized as I got deeper into this that there's a lot of people out there who call themselves experts.
Speak on it. Or gurus, bro. They calling themselves gurus.
Experts. They call themselves gurus. And, you know, they're people with opinions. And so at the beginning of all this, a lot of, you know, those gurus and experts are people that I viewed at as, you know, people to look up to. And now, you know, those same people are people that I'm competing with, you know, for attention, for their audience, for time. And, you know, we give different things. And I believe in abundance, right? Like, there is plenty of space and time and money and energy for all of us. So I don't have to feel threatened by somebody else's success or by somebody else's position based off of what their experience is. But I think it's important, you know, to underscore, I guess, a level of humility when it comes into this, because, you know, I've made statements and I've gotten a lot of pushback from people around, you know, their inability to, or the insensitivity of, I made a statement some months ago on Twitter about, you know, Black people having to let go of the Section 8 mindset.
And get your mentions blow up.
People lit me up,
I only say that because a couple of months ago, I brought up welfare, and when I say they were fit to be tied, they were fit to be tied, bro.
Yeah, I was called so many different names, and I was like, wait a second, like, that's not even me. I was called the misogynist. I was called. And I understand why, and I probed. I was interested to know why, but it was the language that I used, and it was the amount of characters that I had to express myself that really made it come off as very harsh and very direct and very, like, pointing the finger. And language in the tweet that I used specifically that kind of riled up people, and when I say people, specifically Black women, I talked about how this mentality forces the men out of the homes and onto child support. And, you know, that's something that requires so much more time and space to unpack. But the women who were reading that were interpreting it as if to say that, you know, that's a part of their plan, right? Like, they, like, you know, they have to kick the men out, or they, you know, they're going out and strategically putting men on child support so that they can come up. And I was saying it from a perspective of, a lot of times a requirement to qualify is that you are a single mother with children, and you, and, you know, your income and all the income that comes into the house is, you know, accounted for. So it makes it easier for you to get these benefits if you don't have a man in the house. And because of that, you know, there's this cycle that is perpetuated over and over and over again. And I knew that it was serious when my mom called. My mom called me, and she's like, you know, I saw your post and I understand where you're coming from, but now you need to understand. And she broke it down for me, and you know, as part of my story, which is the reason why I was taken aback by this feedback, is, you know, I grew up on Section 8. I grew up with food stamps. I talk about it all the time. I talk about it in my TED Talk. So I was like, how can you feel that I'm so far removed from that experience that I would, you know, I'm talking about it all the time, that I would, you know, basically, like, shit on people who are leveraging that as a, you know, as a tool. But there's a difference, right, between leveraging
that as a
tool.
Right, that's what I was about to say. Did she not get from where you're, because I'm already in your head, I know what you're talking about. Right. Did your mom not get that you weren't talking about people leveraging it to come up? We're talking about people staying on it for 30 years, 40 years.
Exactly, and passing that mentality on generationally. So, you know, one of the things that I do intentionally to kind of start my conversations is I say, you know, that I grew up wanting to be poor. And people, mm-hmm. you know, that's always like a head scratcher, like, you know, he grew up wanting to be poor. What does that mean? But what I'm saying is that when I became conscious of money in the household, my mom was on Section 8 and we had food stamps. And so I thought, and this is not a conversation that she and I had, but I thought that success meant, especially growing up in New York, I thought that success meant when I became an adult that I would have Section 8, that I would have food stamps, that I would have a job. I didn't plan on being a bum, but that, you know, these things would help augment my expenses, and I was adulting, right? So when we don't have the conversations about financial education in the household, you leave these other influences and the perspective of observation to come in and guide what your path looks like. And so my story, my success story, is overcoming the limitations in mindset, because at that time, I didn't believe it was possible for me to own property in my 20s. That was a foreign concept. I didn't know what credit was. And so what fuels my passion is my experience, like the eye opening and the awakening and, you know, the realization that people can go out and afford groceries without having a food stamps card, or that people could, you know, not only not be on Section 8, but own property, generate an income from owning that property, and make a difference in somebody else's life.
To talk it further, what do you think, and I've seen your book, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, it's about financial financial irresponsibility. Explain to the listeners what that is to you, and I'm just going to give you contact with it to me a little bit. It's, you know, people not investing in their 401k, people taking on large amounts of debt, people financing vacations on credit cards. What is financial irresponsibility to you?
So a couple of things. So I titled that book very intentionally, Financially Irresponsible, because I wanted it to, you know, grab people's attention. And the book has two purposes. One, and, you know, first and foremost, this is the answer to your question. Financial irresponsibility to me is not inspecting what it is you accept as a best practice for your personal finances. So, you know, like I opened up, we'll go around and we'll just say, okay, you used 401k as an example. And I know this is like a bone of contention with a lot of traditionalists, but there are people who it's enough for them to know that they have a 401k. Don't know what they're investing in. Don't know how they're balancing those investments. They're just like, I have a 401k and so I'm doing the right thing, right? Like my job giving me benefits in 401k. And in my own independent research, I learned that, you know, the 401k is, you know, there's so many hidden management fees that eat into your principal that, you know, leaving your money there and not being intentional about how you use that product is doing you a disservice.
Bro, I like how you woke up this morning. Go off.
So it's irresponsible for you to just default into what people tell you is the status quo, right? So then I go further to say, you know, the average American has 2.6 credit cards, right? We'll call it 3. And I have 9. So by a traditionalist standard, especially if you're coming out of the Dave Ramsey camp, I'm financially irresponsible because I have so many credit cards. But my 9 credit cards launched me into an 800 credit score. I could go anywhere and buy anything I want to. And so when we talk about financial irresponsibility, we're talking about not being in control of how you manage your finances or what your understanding of the elements that make up your financial picture are. Because you can do things that are not in line with what a traditionalist would say is the best practice for you and still be successful. And so I talk about different stories and experiences that I had navigating this space and pieces of advice that I was given that either turned out to be true, accurate, or inaccurate for me. Like the first piece of advice that I received around investing in the stock market was, don't buy stocks, they're too risky. And so I talk about that experience, right? It kind of scared me because this person that's giving me this advice is somebody that is, you know, close to my family, is somebody who's worked in financial services much longer than I have. And they're telling me not to buy individual stocks. And I'm coming home excited about the fact that I bought 2 shares of Apple.
Not to cut you off, but were they black?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. And so the advice that I was given was to invest in mutual funds instead because it's less risky, you know, you're more diversified, so on and so forth. But going back to that, you know, same train of thought with the 401k, the mutual funds, if you're not careful, have those hidden management fees in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, fast forward X number of years, I hold a lot of Apple. I mean, my position on Apple is very strong. And, you know, thankfully, I didn't take that advice wholeheartedly. I took it with a grain of salt and I continued to invest in an individual stock that I believed in. And, you know, I mean, everybody knows how Apple's doing. So I'm up.
You blessed, bro. You blessed.
But that is challenging. You know, what is the status quo? And I think that's just something that was instilled in me from a young age, right? Like, question everything. Do your own research. Like, don't just accept it for what it is. And a lot of people, you know, especially in this age and this generation, they want the answers. Like, they want it baked quick. Like, okay, let me put it in the microwave, zap it. And then, you know, I don't have to do the work. And I like navigating that, you know, place of discomfort where it says, you know what? Like, most people say you shouldn't do this, but why shouldn't you do this? You know, and how how do you take this situation or this scenario and make it work for you? Because at 21 years old, it made sense for me to do certain things with my money without obligations like a car note and a mortgage, and you know what I'm saying, that don't make sense for me at 30. And so your financial picture is going to change as you navigate through time and space. Your situation changes, how much money you make, whether or not you're single, whether or not you have children, do you have financial obligations? And you can adjust as those situations occur. And so just being real about that, like I can take a position, and the position that I took in my book at the time I was writing it was, I don't contribute to my 401k because of the management fees. I want to be more in control of my money. So I instead take the money that I was contributing there and invest it into an IRA. But then I was like, wait a second, like not investing in the 401k is doing me a disservice because my company is matching me up to a certain dollar amount. So I'm leaving money on the table. Maybe it doesn't mean that I invest in a fund. You know what I'm saying? Maybe it just means that I collect that extra money and then do what I want with it. And so my position, you know, same as then, same as now on 401ks is that it's a tool. I don't plan on using my 401k to retire, but I can certainly leverage my 401k, and I have leveraged my 401k in multiple instances through loans, withdrawals, what have you, to help me build wealth. The biggest example of that was my purchasing my house. I took a loan against my 401k.
You giving me so much. I'm like so excited because I like when someone else says what I say, because I think sometimes the listeners or the people on Twitter who might listen to this will hear it from a different perspective, because my delivery is not always the best. But to piggyback off what you said, I think you're very right. And this is why I always tell people that I don't want you to use one financial vehicle. I want you to use a combination of them all.
Oh, yeah.
And what you said about leveraging the 401k to purchase your house, most people don't even know you can take a loan on your own 401k at a lower rate than you could get at a bank, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, that baffles people. Like, your job is willing to give you a loan at an immensely lower rate with no credit check. Like, let's talk about that. No credit check. You can literally just submit a request to take out a loan.
Yep.
And they'll give you that, and they'll let you pick a time frame you want to pay it out. It automatically comes out of your check. And it's like a no thinking process. But in addition to that, kind of what you were saying is like the 401k should be a tool in addition to you having a Roth IRA, in addition to you having a online brokerage account, in addition to having a high yield savings account. It should be, your portfolio should be a bevy of financial vehicles that is helping you fulfill your financial plan. And it's so telling that, you know, when, like you said, when you had the time and you didn't have so many financial obligations, you took advantage of that to leverage that situation to purchase your first home.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of piggyback off what you said, when someone was telling you that we shouldn't buy stocks, do you think that we are directed to buy mutual funds or ETFs instead of individual stocks where the highest return is? Because people have this either conscious or unconscious bias that Black people lack the mental capacity to evaluate and research individual stocks.
I think that is a good suggestion. And I think that there's definitely truth to that. But I think it depends on who's making the suggestion, right? So like this piece of advice came from a family friend who is Black, right? And, you know, they are invested, like they have a 401k, they have mutual funds. It was considered a safe bet, but, you know, that was their risk tolerance, right? And, you know, that's the part of the process when you sit down with a financial advisor. And I kind of talk about this too in my book, was like, we have a reluctance to go and pay for the professional. And so we want to do it all on our own, but we do it half-assed, right? Like you don't know what you don't know. And so rather than sit with a CPA who can tell you all the ins and outs of navigating, you know, the tax loopholes, you want to go to H&R Block and, you know, try to get back the most money that you can, or you want to do it on TurboTax for free. So I think that's an element of it. It's just the ignorance. And I think another part of it is just, you know, not wanting to take your own personal accountability to, like you said, do the research and figure it out. But I think we live in a dangerous time as well, because with COVID especially, I have noticed all over social media and through publications and what have you, like, yeah, Black people are starting to get very much more involved in the stock market. They're starting to invest, but they're starting to invest, you know, from that perspective of, you know, like, oh, my eyes are bigger than my stomach, right? I see people making gains and posting their gains on social, so I want to get involved because I want to make money. and not understanding the different nuances of what investing looks like and the difference between what investing and trading is, right?
Please tell them the difference between investing and trading.
So, you know, they go in there like, I touch a stock, that means I'm invested. But let me turn around and try and flip that. And I'm like, well, no, you're not investing. Like, you're buying stock at a particular price. You're flipping. Like, you're buying
it at a price. You're gambling. I call it gambling.
Well, I do too. I do too. And it's the most dangerous way to get involved. But it's just like, do you take the silver lining and say, well, you know what? Black people are starting to become interested in investing. They're starting to become interested in, you know, these publicly traded companies and understanding what that means and putting their money towards, you know, what could be assets. Or do you look at it from the risk perspective, right? And, you know, you and I can do that with a background in financial services and say, hey, like, you know, you're on a slippery slope here, and you know, one wrong move and you're going to lose everything. And then your state of mind, your mind frame is not going to allow for you to recover, because now you're like panicking. And so I have to be careful, and you know, we all do, when it comes to advising on, you know, these securities and the exchange of these securities, because I'm not licensed to tell you what to buy and what not to buy. And that's the number one question that I get. What stock should I buy? Well, what are you invested in? And I'm like, I can't tell you that. I'm not going to tell you that, because what is my risk tolerance is not what your risk tolerance is. I've been holding Apple since 2016, maybe earlier. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've seen Apple go through the ups and downs. I've had financial advisors, licensed financial advisors, tell me to dump it all. And I listened, but half-assed. I dumped half of what I was holding, and I regret it every day.
Yeah.
Because I was like, you know.
Because your instincts were screaming to you to hold it, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, I believed in it. And I was just like, you know, that's why I held the other half.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see the returns based off of how long I've been holding, I'm like, man, if I would have just kept that and kept buying, I would have been good. But, you know, here I am, uneducated, and listening to this is financial irresponsibility. Listening to the financial advisor who's not invested at all in my process, right? Like, I'm not paying them. It's just somebody that I know telling me to dump Apple because of the way that they speculate. And so I think the biggest message for people to understand is that, you know, guru, expert, no expert. Everybody's human. Like, everybody's having their experiences. And certainly your perspective may be more informed than somebody else's because of the things that you know. But that doesn't make you God. Like, you can't predict the future. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And so, like, are you surrendering your financial destiny to somebody else because you think they know more than you? Like, come on.
Yeah. So do you educate people in group settings, individual settings? Do you do families? Like, how does that work in your industry of educating people to be financially empowered?
I try to do it all. I try to be as versatile as possible where there's a need. I recently started working with, and this is a combination of a lot of different things happening, but really recently started working with young people. Mm-hmm. So that is like before 20 and early 20s. And, you know, that's a different skill set as a teacher, and keeping them engaged, right? Because you're talking about things that maybe they haven't even touched yet. Credit, retirement, like, they're not even thinking about these things. So definitely individual. I think, you know, with the coaching piece of it, individual is definitely like, that's my thing. That's what I love. People are more transparent. People are more vulnerable, and they're more receptive. Certainly groups. But I try to put out as much content as I can in as many different ways as I can so that everybody can have a little piece, right? So, like, I'm working on a workbook right now. I have a book out. I have, you know, the podcast that I've been on. I've written articles, you know, whatever I can get out there for people to, like, you know, have a little piece of and start that train of thought is really where I want to be. So I'm not counting anybody out yet.
Hey, together, because I always like to talk about this, and we're in the same consulting field. Giving out free information like you do on the articles, like being on here with me on the podcast, let people know that doesn't affect the amount of business that you get. People have this scarcity mindset. When you give people free information, they're not going to book my services. That's money out of my pocket. Not really, because a good promotion, tell me if I'm wrong, but I experienced a good portion of your client base reads your material and still comes to you for consulting fees or any services that you might charge for, correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's definitely something that I wrestled with in the beginning, too. Like, I wanted to hold on to the nitty gritty and just kind of post generalist ideas. But I found the most engagement occurs when you get into it. And people become interested, people want to reach out, they want to learn more, they want you to help them in the process of whatever that is. So yeah, give it all. Like, I mean, you could give somebody the playbook, and because they don't have the context to understand how to navigate that playbook, they're going to come to you for the coaching. That's just what it is.
I would be remiss, you know, me being a Black man, you being a Black man, and I've had several ladies on and had them go into details of what it is to be a Black woman in tech, an entrepreneur. Talk about the specific financial risk for Black men and also their need to get on more financial footing in this society and in the future, and how it will help the overall culture and power.
That's a really loaded question, though. I'm gonna do my best to answer it because, again, from my experience, I think it's very important for me to underscore in this particular setting. My corporate career has been in finance, you know, going into 10 years next year. Mm-hmm. You know, starting as a part-time teller at 21 years old, and the amount of microaggression, disrespect, belittling, undermining, the games, the politics, the things that you have to just kind of swallow to keep moving is not for everybody. Not everybody is strong enough to do it, because there's conversations had with peers, family members, what have you. Like, I couldn't do what you do, Rakim. It's very stressful, and it attacks your concept of masculinity, right? Your concept of manhood, when you have somebody who doesn't look like you, who might be older than you, who might be a male, who might be a female, dictating what is your worth, right? Mm. Dictating how fast you can progress, dictating how much money you can get, whether or not you get bonuses, how you perform. And in instances where you know that you know more, or that you're better able or better qualified, it's frustrating, it's discouraging. And I think that's one of the things that keeps me fired up on my entrepreneurial endeavors, is that, you know, depending on that stream of income in that environment can be very toxic. And you have one of two choices. You can, or I should say one of several choices, but the overwhelming majority of people look at it from the position of two choices: either go all in, right, and just drink the Kool-Aid,
or
leave, mm-hmm. get out of that environment. And, you know, financial services, the finance industry in and of itself is a very lucrative industry to be in. It's a small industry, as small as it is large, in that you're going to navigate the same circles of people across the same different financial giants, right? Like, you know, you might one day work at a bank like Bank of America and then end up at another bank and see somebody from your previous life at Bank of America working where you're working now. So with that, your reputation is like so important. And if you come off as this combative, aggressive, non-friendly, threatening Black man, it's going to be hard for you to move in that space. One of the things that I frequently get complimented on in my circles corporate is my diplomacy. But that's strategic. Like, that's playing chess. I have to be diplomatic, because if I said what I wanted to say when I wanted to say it, I wouldn't have a job anymore. And so, you know, I don't want to make a woe is me, the man is trying to keep me down narrative as a Black man in that space. But, you know, you're going in and you're competing with predominantly white men who, you know, who navigate this field. And, you know, the higher up in the ranks you get, the more you start to realize that it's about your network. It's about who you know. It's not about what you know. It's not about the amount of time that you put in. It's not about whether or not you can even do the job. It's about you're a part of the boys club and they appointed you as the director of this region because. And that's
just because I like that. Just because.
And that's difficult. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And I think for me, being as young as I am and to have accomplished what I've accomplished, that's trailblazing, right? Like, I'm putting in work. I'm sacrificing for my family, for, you know, my legacy, who comes after me, so that they don't have to do that. They don't have to take orders. They don't have to, you know, put on a smile and change the way they talk. And, you know what I'm saying? Like, code switching is definitely a thing that happens every day when I go to work. It's like, okay, like, I gotta sit here and play this game. And I really, you know, some days don't want to.
That is so dope. We've talked about so much. And we're almost at time, so I'm definitely going to have you on again, because it's a wealth of information I think that the culture definitely needs. But to wrap it up, give the listeners one bit of information or advice that you think may be needed within the next year or two, financially, with the pandemic on the horizon, you know, still running around, vaccines possibly coming around, working, potentially becoming more remote. And after you've done that, if you can give them your social media handles, your websites, where they can find your books, all that good information.
Sure. So I think the biggest piece of advice, and it's going to be two-pronged, I always advocate for paying yourself first, but paying yourself first now is so much more important, because you don't know when that interruption in income is going to come with the pandemic, especially if you, if you're holding down a full-time job. But, and this is a reality that I was knocked in the head with, this year too, focus on creating those additional streams of income. And there's so many ways to make money. There's a ton of ways to make money. It's just, you know, finding your niche and you know, digging your heels in. Even if it's a very small amount, you know, it's a start. It's something. And then as you start to pick up momentum, those streams will pick up momentum as well, either in volume or in the different streams that you can create based off of that initial one. But definitely going into, you know, next year and maybe beyond, those controlling your income streams or creating them and paying yourself first is going to be crucial. As far as where you can find me, all of my handles are at my name. So that's Rakim Sabree, RAHKIMSABREE. And my website is rakimsabree.com. So I make it very easy to find me. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, I'm on all of them. And my book is called Financially Irresponsible. That's available on Amazon. But you can find links to that on my social
media. All right. We definitely like to thank Rakim for coming on and sharing that information. He has like such a wealth of information. I don't want to give it to you guys in all overwhelming bites, so I'll definitely work with him in the schedule to see about having him on another time or two, just to kind of take different avenues and different topics, so we can give you all the wealth of information. Because as I always tell you guys, I don't know it all, but I can get the people on here who may know more details and specifics and specific fields and subjects. This has been another episode of The Culture is Money. I'll talk to you guys soon.
That's right. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Culture's Money. You can follow Jamal on Instagram and Twitter at Leo Grand Prince. That's Leo Grand Prince. You can also get in contact with Jamal via Facebook and LinkedIn. Just type in his name. That's Jamal, J-A-M-A-A-L, Vitos, V-E-T-O-S-E. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on The Culture's Money, baby.